Let's jump right back into Parsha Vayitze with a very quick recap, because I want to get right to the material. We've got a lot of stuff to really dig into today. We talked last time about how Parsha Vayitze, we see that there's only one block paragraph for the entire Parsha, indicating that on a Chumash level, meaning what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to tell us with the fact that it's only one block paragraph, that there's one inyan in this Parsha, and that is Galus, that is Vayitze, going out into Galus, and experiencing and both surviving and thriving in Galus, and whatever that comes along with that. And we then moved to Yaakov's first stop on that journey. Yaakov makes a stop at this Makom, which we defined as Har Abayit and Beit HaMikdash according to Chazal. He stops at Har Abayit and Beit HaMikdash just like all of the other Avos, according to Chazal, made stops at Makom HaMikdash. Abraham at a certain point, Yitzchak at a certain point, Yaakov now is stopping at Makom HaMikdash. What that means is, he said it's two things. One is that they all had a different experience there. We have to understand what that tells us about the Beit HaMikdash. But similarly, if they're all stopping there, the nature of that experience they have there is not only going to tell us about the Beit HaMikdash, but it's going to reflect back onto their own efforts. So by looking at the story of what Yaakov brings out in the Beit HaMikdash, it tells us a lot about who Yaakov is. It's reflecting Yaakov's relationship to Beit HaMikdash. And that's what we're going to really dig into today. To that, I want to just quickly take a look at the Pesukim that we're going to be working off of, which is the opening of Parshat Vayitze. Let's just see them inside. Very opening of the Parsha. Perek Chavchet Pasuk Yud. Vayitze Yaakov mi Be'er Shava Vayilech Charana. Yaakov leaves Be'er Shava and goes toward Charan. Vayifga b'makom. He comes to this makom. Again, this undefined place, which, by the way, on a Chumash level, Makom Mikdash, Yerushalayim always remains as an undefined place. It's always referred to as Hamakom or something else, but never actually defined for reasons we won't define right now. Vayifgab Makom, Vayalan Sham, and he goes to sleep there. And we talked about the connections already between Yaakov being the paradigm of exile and darkness and going out into the night and going to sleep. We'll talk about it more, but already how that, we already set the stage for that. But he has his vision, his experience of Makom HaMikdash in a dream, sleeping in a dream. Kiva HaShemesh, because the Shemesh came down. By the way, the Shemesh going down is also indicative of the beginning of nighttime. His life is starting, his exile is starting, and the sun is going down. When Yaakov returns from exile, in Parshat Vayishlach, the next Parsha, not Parshat Vayitze, not the Parsha of exile, he comes back. In order to get back, he's going to have to encounter whom?
Esav,
right? That final battle with Esav. He's going to have to encounter Esav. And then we're actually told, I'm in Periklam Abep, Pasuk Lam and Aleph. Vayizrach lo Hashemesh kasher avar et Penuel. Right after he fights with the Sarosh al Esav, it's not the final confrontation with Esav as it appears in the text, but when he fights and overcomes the Sarosh al Esav, Vayizrach lo Hashemesh. There's this kind of balance of the two sides, of the leaving the sun going down and coming back from exile and the sun going up. In any event, so the sun goes down. Again, the emphasis on Makom. He's lying down, he's sleeping. His experience of Makom Mikdash is lying down, sleeping, and having a dream. There's a ladder which is firmly implanted on the ground, and it's Rosho is Magia Hashemaima. The head of the ladder is going up into the heavens. And the angels, so to speak, of God. We'll use this word from now on, malachim. Angels doesn't really mean anything. It's just an empty English word. The malachim are going up and down this ladder. They're going up and down the ladder. V'hinei Hashem nitzav alav. And God is somehow standing above the ladder. V'yomer, ani Hashem Elokei Avraham, avicha v'elokei Yitzchak, ha'aretz she'ata shochev aleha lecha atnena v'lizarecha. This land that you're sleeping on, I'm going to give to you and to your children after you. Tov. So like we said before, the way that we're going to come to perceive the world and the Beit HaMikdash is going to reflect who he is. The way that he has this dream, his experience, is going to reflect who he is and his identity. To start going into that, let's really get into the kind of crux of the dream. Let's get into the crux of the dream. We have our ladder, right? And we have down here the Eretz, and it's going up to Shamayim, and we have the Malachei Elokim going up and down. Okay? Our two basic spaces here are Shamayim and Eretz. We have a ladder that's linking here, Shamayim and Aretz. How do we understand what Shamayim and Aretz are? If you were to think about how to define Shamayim, what is Shamayim? So, literally, it could mean the sky. Think a little bit more abstractly. What does Shamayim always represent?
The upper world.
Upper worlds. Olam Haba. Olam Haba, excellent. Olam Haba. We have the Olamot Elyonim is really how we translate what you said.
What's that?
Upper worlds. Olamot Elyonim. Olamot Elyonim. English words, metaphysical space, transcendental, spirituality, right? Shamayim is what's detached from the lowliness of the earthiness of the land. It's up above, it's transcendental, it's beyond. These are great words we have to come back to. That's already taking it a step further. Excellent. But this is the more spiritual place, the more lofty place. In fact, give me a pasuk that we're all familiar with, which indicates the more spiritual essence of Shamayim as opposed to Aretz. Those who were in Halacha, we actually covered this not so long ago. From Tehillim.
Shamayim Hashem Aretz Mekamim.
Excellent. Excellent. We talked about that in the context of saying a bracha and transitioning something from being Shamayim to Aretz in the beginning of Mem Vav. But yeah, Shamayim, Shamayim LaHashem, Aretz LaMeinam. Shamayim is Shamayim LaHashem. Here it's for Hashem. Here it's more spiritual. Here it's more transcendental. Hashamayim, Shamayim LaHashem. The Aretz that Hanivnei Adam. This dichotomy between Shamayim and Aretz is also something which is reaching all the way back to the very beginning of creation itself. Where do we see in the beginning of creation?
Oh, when it's split into water.
Don't have to go that far.
Oh.
Right, think about that for a second. The very, very first pasuk. Bereshit bara Elokim, et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. The world is created with this dichotomy of a shamayim and an aretz. And somehow this distance between the two, of the transcendental, spiritual plane of existence versus the earthy, physical plane of existence. That's how the whole reality is set up from the very first pasuk. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Whether or not it's chronological or not, it doesn't matter. We've talked about this in the past. The chronology is relevant. If God is intentionally undermining chronology for a greater purpose, then even more so, how much it must be soaked in meaning that he's opening up with et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. That reality is somehow about dealing with this dichotomy. Upper, transcendental, spiritual versus lower, earthy, physical. Tov. Let's add further layers to the distinction between Shamayim and Aretz. If you have a Chumash in front of you, take a look to some very, very beautiful Pesukim at the end of Parshat Ekev. In Devarim, it's Perek Yud Aleph, Pesukim Yud through Yud Bet. Some of my favorite Pesukim in Chumash, and when I listened to Rabbi Shir, he said they're also some of his favorite Pesukim in Chumash, which was just nice to see that we're somewhat on the same page on certain things. Perek Yud Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud. It's a very short, there's a paragraph break before and after these three Pesukim. So it's the, again, the Chumash indicating that these are a self-contained unit. Incredible poetry about the beauty of Eretz Yisrael, and like all poetry, it has layers and layers and layers of meaning, even just looking at it on the surface. We're not going to go into that. I just want to take a little bit from this to emphasize the point. What the Torah is doing at this point in Parshat Ekev is describing the difference between Eretz Mitzrayim, one of the major differences, one of the essential differences between Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael. Listen to the Pesukim. Ki ha'aretz asher atava shama lirishta. Lo ke'eretz Mitzrayim. The land which you're going to come into, Eretz Yisrael, is not like Eretz Mitzrayim. How do we define Eretz Mitzrayim? It's amazing that this is how the Chumash in this paragraph is defining Eretz Mitzrayim. Asher yatzatem misham, which you left from there. Asher tizra et zaracha v'yishkita v'ragelcha g'gan ha'yarach. Which you plant and then you water with your feet. Meaning one of the basic explanations is that you either have to go down and pick up the water in buckets and go and drag them out or create an irrigation system or have the overflowing of the Nile, whatever it may be. But the point is, you go and you're watering the land from below. Now this is in contrast to Eretz Yisrael. This is the contrast to Eretz Yisrael. Unbelievable. Again, think about what that means. Va'aretz asher atem ovrim shama lirishta. The land which you are now going over to inherit. Eretz Harim Ufkaot. It's a land of mountains and valleys. Limtar Hashamayim Tishtemayim. You're going to get your water from the heavens, from Shamayim. Limtar Hashamayim Tishtemayim. You will drink your water from the heavens. Meaning, differentiating between somehow that earthy relationship to a more spiritual relationship, but adding an extra wrinkle to the spiritual relationship. Shamayim is inherently linked to what?
Spiritual.
No, I'm saying basically it's psukim. The Mayim, or more specifically, meaning there's Mayim in both.
Holy Mayim.
Pshat. What is the word? Just Pshat.
God.
Matar, or Geshem. Just very simply. Meaning as opposed to drawing it up from the ground, the sky is going to rain down water. And somehow that indicates, in the next pasuk, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Ota, a land which God is seeking out. Tamidei Hashem Elokecha Ba, God's eyes are always on this land, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So that's being indicated in the relationship of Shamayim specifically, it being a more Shamayim-oriented relationship, as is expressed through the rain. Let's add one more layer to the rain. This is, if you have a Tanakh, you'll see it. If you don't have a Tanakh, you can listen. From Yishayahu, from the Haftarah that we actually read on fast days. Also, unbelievably beautiful psukim. We're in Yishayahu, Perek Nun Hei, to a full Tanakh, Pasuk Chet. God says, Perek Nun Hei, Pasuk Chet. Your ways of thinking are not like my ways of thinking, and your ways are not like my ways, says Hashem. Meaning there's a difference between man and God. Ki kavu shamayim me'aretz. Just as the distance between the sky and the land, meaning as far and distant apart as they are, the spiritual from the physical, the transcendental from the practical on the ground. So too are how much higher and farther away my ways from your ways of machshavotayim and machshavotayim, and my ways of thinking from your ways of thinking. Just like, and hear the analogy here, listen to it carefully. Just like the rain and the snow come down from the heavens, v'shama lo yashuv, and they never come back up. Ki'im hirva et ha'aretz, until they've penetrated the ground, the holy da v'yitzmicha, and impregnated and produced fruit. V'natan zera lazorea v'lechem la'ochel, and eventually are then able to feed people. Kein ihiyet dvari asher yitzimi pi, so too are the words that come out of my mouth, so to speak, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lo yashuvei la'reikam, they don't come back to me empty. Ki masad asher chafatzti, until they do that which I desired, v'yitzliach asher shalachtiv, and they fulfill my shlichut. Meaning, just like the Shamayim sends down the rain, and the rain naturally penetrates the ground and fulfills its goal and its purpose and gives life to the ground, so too, says God, does when I speak, do I see my words, do they come and they penetrate reality, and they produce, they accomplish that which I send it to do, and they would never return to me empty-handed. You see the mashal and the nimshal? No. Just like the way that the Shamayim as heavens or skies expresses itself in its relationship to the lower realm, to the ground, it sends it down, its messages, its goals, its intent through the rain, and the rain always penetrates the earth to accomplish its goal, or its shlichut, as it's basically being said here in the pasuk, and will never come back empty-handed. So too, says God, when I send down my ratzon, my will, from Shamayim, from the heavens, from now, okay. I send down my will, it never goes back empty-handed, meaning this is in contrast to whom? Us. It's a big musar for us, about thinking about how every single thing, if we were trying to live out our tzelem Elokim, it means that every time that we speak, it should be speaking with intent, with an intended purpose, and making sure that that purpose is fulfilled, that that's the ideal, that's living B'Tzelem Elokim, but that it's always going to go and it's going to fulfill its purpose. Tov. Let's get this piece. What would the malachim then be in this vision?
Many people.
Nope. Throw it out. Just to be able to lose some time. They're like the rain, which is the shaliach, which is exactly what the pasuk parallels. Right? That was the end. That was the end of the last pasuk that we read. Ki masad sher chafatzi v'yitzliach asher shelachtiv. The shlichim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are his malachim. In fact, there are sources that indicate, and more explicitly, that all a malach is a clear, defined, explicit ratzon Hashem that's manifest in the world. That's why, as an aside, a malach can't have more than one task. Right? That's why God has to send three malachim to Abraham. One to give the news, one to
destroy
Sodom, and one to save Lot.
No, I thought Refuah.
One for Refuah for Avraham Avinu, right. One to destroy Sodom, one to Refuah for Avraham Avinu. Each one has a specific shlichut. But why couldn't that malach have three shlichuts? Why does it matter? The answer is because each one of those malachim is Ratzon Hashem manifest. That's the malach that's coming down here, va to Aretz, below something Eli Reikam, within the Pasuk. They're not going to come back to me empty. Meaning the malachim that are going back, going down in their shlichut with an intended purpose will always fill their purpose. God will never send out a ratzon, a malach, that won't fill its purpose, and then comes back up, so to speak, I guess, to indicate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the purpose has been fulfilled, whatever way that means. But the malachim that are coming down are the ratzon Hashem that's coming up and down from Shemayim, which are manifest in the rain. Yes?
Aren't there certain malachim who didn't do the ratzon of Hashem?
I can think of one example in one medrash. Other than that, not so much.
Okay.
Unless you know more than I do. Which is very possible.
Is it about the tree one?
What?
The tree, like in the beginning of creation.
It's not a malach, it's a tree.
I don't know. Oh, that was not supposed to be like a malach. That was the malach that made. Okay, I don't know.
There's one malach that I'm aware of in one particular midrash, but other than that, I'm not familiar.
But, like, so fine, even that example, like, is that...
Then one has to understand and assume that nothing really can go against the Kadosh Baruch Hu's will, so then there must have been some sort of intent there that that malach would have failed, so to speak, and it needs to be understood in the context of that midrash. Okay. There are three things which exist in a parallel, and I was very excited because I never actually looked up the Midrash inside, and I did a little research, and I found a Midrash which literally says it word for word. I didn't realize that it was so concise. There are three things in reality that parallel each other. Says the Midrash, which we've been talking about these types of Midrashim for the last few weeks. Lamedcha, this is the Midrash Tanchuman Parshat Pekude, Siman Gimel. Lamdecha, Shehamishkan, the Mishkan, which is a prototype for the Beit HaMikdash, the Mishkan of the Beit HaMikdash, Shakul Kineged Kol HaOlam, the Mishkan is a microcosm, or the Beit HaMikdash is a microcosm for all of reality, while at the same time, Ukineged Yitzirat HaAdam, Shu'olam Katan, and also is a parallel to a human being, because a human being is called an Olam Katan in Chazal. So, the reality is a macrocosm of the Mishkan, and a person is a microcosm of both the Mishkan and of all reality. But the three are all paralleling each other, and there's so much to talk about on that, and that's basically what we've been talking about in Drashot and Shalosh Shizis for the last 5 weeks. There's a lot of content support into that. That's not our topic at this particular moment. What that means is, if we're building a paradigm here, it's going to work on all levels. This reality that we set up of the Shamayim and the Aretz being two opposites, which are being drawn together, these Malachim are sending messages down and forth, and the latter is unifying them, that's the image of reality itself. The only other being that is comprised of two opposites that are forced together in this way, these extreme opposites, what is that other being? Or the only being? Is a human being. What two opposites are we comprised of?
Shema.
A nishama, a guf, a transcendental, spiritual, olam haba oriented nishama, and a physical, earthy, olam hazeh, eretz oriented body. were comprised of these two opposites that have to be drawn together. That's why an Adam is an Olam Katan. He's comprised of both Shamayim and Aretz, Neshama and Guf. And what that means is that Hashem creates the world as two separate parts that are meant to be unified, and this unification also happens within every single person with the Neshama and the Guf, which, by the way, also happens in the Beit HaMikdash. The Gemara says that the Beit HaMikdash is the space, is the place in reality, uses the Lashon of the Gemara, where Shamayim and Aretz kiss. It's the unification, it's the coming together of Shamayim and Aretz. All three of them, and that's which makes sense because Yaakov is having this dream where?
Makom.
On Makom HaMikdash. Meaning this is his experience of what the Beit HaMikdash is and is going to be. It's going to be this unification, this space in reality, which is a unification of Shamayim and Aretz. Question before we take to the next stage. Everybody's good? Everybody not good? Seriously, something. A nod. A yelp. Cry for help. Joy, excitement. Anything's good. Thank you, Allie. It was you? Oh, thank you. I didn't know if you wanted it on. Thank you, Hannah Walks. Tov. So let's take this to the next stage and let's contemplate this. Think about this with fresh eyes. It's something which we often take for granted. Think about this in a new way. Okay? Let's say a person wants to move their hand. Let's say I want to move my hand. So what happens? So I can move my hand. What's happening physiologically? So my muscles are being stretched because I'm sending down a message from my mind, from my brain, through my nervous system, to cause my muscles to either expand or contract. And that's all happening from that message that's coming from my head all the way through to my hand. That's what's happening on a physical level. And up to that point, everything can be proven by science beautifully and precisely. When we take it to the next stage, though, we have to ask ourselves or think, what is the cause of that movement? What is really the ultimate cause of that movement? Yes, it's the signals from my brain which are causing my hand to move. But where's the ultimate source of the desire to cause the brain to send the signal to cause my hand to move? Right, no, I'm saying, but we don't know where it is physically. I mean, it is Bechira Choshit, or it's going to be, using different Lashonot that we've been referring to here. Where is that coming from? What part of myself is that coming from?
Why is it not your brain? Or your mind?
So that's the question of the mind-body problem. Meaning nobody would if you look inside a person's head, you'll find a mass of gray matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really do anything. Meaning there is a spark that comes from there. There is that beginning of movement that comes from there on a physical level. But think about it like this, and I once read this in an amazing book. It was the first time I ever read any kind of philosophy, like a deep philosophy, and it got me interested in philosophy to begin with, long before I got into Jewish philosophy. The writer of this particular book expresses it as follows. Do you say you are a body or you have a body?
Have.
Do you say you are a brain or you have a brain?
You have a brain.
So then who are you? That's the mind-body dichotomy. Yeah, it's not me. It's a very brilliant philosopher who just very concisely put it that way. I have a brain. But if I have a brain, then I am not my brain. Meaning, we intuitively know that there's some part of me that exists beyond or outside of my physical self, above my physical self, which we can't detect based on science. We can't detect in the physical world because it doesn't exist in the physical world.
Why can't it be a combination of body and brain?
We're a... No, so the first inkling on a physical level of an expression of that desire is going to happen on a physical level in the brain. But where does that desire come from? Where does that ratzon come from? That's coming from some place more transcendental.
The ratzon for what? To move?
The desire to move. This is an example. The decision to do anything, the desire to do anything, is coming from a higher place. That place is my Shemayim, that's my Neshama. That's what science is never going to be able to find. That's my spiritual part of me.
Sorry, I don't understand why you skipped the part. That was really cool what you just said about I have a body, I have a brain. Mm-hmm. Why can't... But you're not... But I am not my body and I am not my brain. Why can't...
A scientific
approach would be I am a combination of my body and brain.
No, because you still wouldn't say... Would you say, I have a body and a brain, yeah. Or I am a body and a brain? Same question.
That
It's just the way we phrase it.
To be a word for body brain combo.
It's what we call the mind, meaning in philosophy they call it the mind-body dichotomy or issue. Meaning it's the question of what is the mind. So philosophers will say, we'll deal with what is the issue of the mind, where does the mind exist, what is it? Okay. That would be the question. We're saying the mind is much more transcendental than just a mind. It's the very core of my being, it's my very self, it's my soul. That's my shamayim side. That's undefinable. That's not that we can't detect with physical instruments in this world.
And that's why you're saying this comes from your.
It comes from the electrical circuits all the way back up from the brain. But what's the ultimate
mind
source?
Is telling it to do it, and what's that mind? That mind's okay.
It's my soul. Intuitively, the desire comes from someplace else that's beyond the physical and the measurable. Yet it produces a completely physical process. This is the meeting point between the mind, or the neshama, and the body, and the guf. As long as we exist within the confines of this world, as long as we exist within the confines of Olam HaZeh, that's something that we're never going to be able to detect. Meaning we're never going to be able to see Olam Haba from an outside perspective, if we're living in Olam HaZeh. Olam HaZeh is the world that we live in. We often think of Olam Haba, by the way, as the world to come. It's that thing which is coming next. Which is implied by the word haba, meaning it's what we will experience chronologically next. But according to our deeper sources, olam haba is not something which will magically appear after olam hazeh falls away. But rather, olam haba is the spiritual reality which is behind the veil of this reality. And in the next world, meaning when we transition from our perspective to the next phase, that veil will fall away and we'll just see what was the spiritual reality that was there the entire time. But olam haba and olam hazeh are existing simultaneously. And I'm expressing that place, that neshama, which is coming from Olam Haba in Olam Hazeh. It's the connection between Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh, the spiritual realm and the physical realm, the body and the soul. And as we said before, those are being united in the Beit HaMikdash. Now, every morning, we go through a recognition of the impossibility of uniting these intrinsic opposites. There's nothing more opposite than a neshama and a guf. There's nothing more opposite than a shamayim and an arts. And every single morning, we discussed this last semester in Midrashah as well, in the halacha component. According to Rov Poskim and Rov Min Hagim, there's actually something that we do in the morning to indicate this impossible unification between the body and the soul. What is that? Excellent. Connecting Asher Yatzar to Elokei Neshama. When we wake up in the morning, we say a bracha of Asher Yatzar, and according to most minhagim and most poskim, we take the physical part. We take the physical part of ourselves. We give a bracha on our guf, on our body, on our physical self, and we make it one bracha aruka. According to most minhagim, we make it one bracha aruka. And connected to Elokei Neshama, which is all about my soul. What are the words that connect, that bind those two brachot? What's the last words of Asher Yatzar? Last two words. Umafli la'asot. And that's what the Rama says in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Vav. He says, what is mafli la'asot? What mafli la'asot means the wonderment that you do, God. What's this wonderment? It could be all of the things that we described in Asher Yatzar about how God takes care of our bodies. Rama says, no. I'll tell you what the wonderment is, what the most biggest, most impossible wonderment is in all of reality. The Odish the Faresh is the Rama, in Siman Vav, Sif Aleph. Odish the Faresh, Mafli La'asot, B'masha Shomer Ruach HaAdam B'Kirbo, V'Kosher Davar Ruchani, B'Davar Gashmi. You want to find the most wondrous thing that there is in life? That there can be a being that unites the spiritual and the physical. That's what it is. And that's why Mafli La'asot unites Elokei Neshama and Asher Yatzar. Of course, the Rama whose minhag wasn't even to unite those two brachot. So go take that. Right? And that's what we're doing when we wake up in the morning. Tov. Let's take it one step further. Question up until this point. We're gonna go... Miriam?
Yeah.
We're going to go a couple minutes over, I apologize. Question before I take it to the next step. We haven't brought it back to anything yet, so I want to see it come full circle. But we're building. We're getting there. It'll be online. Yeah.
So if Olam Habat is available behind the physical, and not necessarily only chronological, does that mean that it's possible for someone to experience Olam Haba in this life? Do you see what I'm saying?
A person is meant to see as much emet as possible in a world of sheker. What's another word for Olam Haba?
Olam
Haemet. The goal is to try to see as much of Olam Haba and Olam Haza as you can, and there's a lot of philosophy that can lead in that direction, in terms of Chazal, in terms of Kabbalistic writings, even in terms of the shape of certain letters. There's a lot of ways to see how Olam Haba actually exists within Olam Haza, and our goal is to peel back that veil to the greatest extent that we can, while still recognizing that there's a certain limitation that until we finish our time in this world, we're not going to see it fully. Okay. Let's take it to its last step here, its last stage. So we get this right. We're going for it. Okay. Man, we've been discussing about how man embodies the dichotomy between Shemayim and Aretz. Physically speaking, how is that represented in the physical manifestation of mankind? Think about physiologically, biologically, just practically, how we're constructed. How is this concept of us uniting Shemayim and Aretz reflecting itself even in the way that we're physically structured? Very simply, as opposed to any other creature on earth.
We stand up.
We stand upright.
Our head is higher than our heart.
Our head is up and our feet are down. I mean, it's also higher than our heart, true. But very simply, as Emily said, we are the only beings on the planet who stand upright.
Kangaroos.
Yeah. They can hop, but...
But they stand up.
Yeah.
They're kind of slouched. Their posture's not great.
So thanks to being. Human beings are the quintessential being of having their... standing upright with their head towards Shemayim and their feet on the ground. By the way, what's the direct opposite whose physical structure is entirely snake. On the ground? The snake or the nachash.
But you know what's another good one?
Let's come back to that after. We're short on time. Okay. That's indicated by the physical structure of man. What allows mankind to stand upright? What part of the body?
Spine.
Vertebrae.
The spine. And the vertebrae. Excellent. Yeah, you're on the ball. The spine. The spine is what allows us to stand up straight. The spine also has a second function other than just allowing us to stand upright. What else does it do? What does it serve as? What's inside of the spine?
Bones, nerves.
The spinal cord, which does what? What does it do?
It connects the brain to the rest of the body.
It connects the brain to the rest of the body. What? That's as far as we're going to go. We're good. Okay? Man is upright. The spine keeps mankind upright. And additionally, the spine sends the signals. It contains the heart of the nervous system. It sends the signals from the brain to the rest of the body and back. Okay? What makes man unique is that he binds Shemayim and Aretz, and since he is an Olam Katan, it's not just that he's comprised of an Neshama and a Guf. He's physically comprised. Mankind is physically comprised with the head in Shemayim and the legs in the Aretz being bound by a spine or and a spinal column, which is what keeps it upright. The spinal column, which is what sends messages all the way from a person's top, from their Rosh, and back down from the bottom all the way back up top. Literally, the image of the Sulam Mutsav Arza, the Roshom Magia Hashamaima, the Malachi Elokim Olim V'Yordimbo. With the Malachim here acting as the nervous system, the Shamaim is the Rosh, and the feet are the Arts. We're built in that image. There's a parallel between the universe, mankind, and the Mishkan that's inescapable, and that's happening in the very structure of a person. This also fits back into everything that Yaakov is about. Let's bring it back to Yaakov, and then we'll wrap up with that. Let's bring it back to Yaakov. We've been talking about the Midot of the Sefirot. I'm not going to go through the whole background. Hopefully, we've all got it down pretty well. The Midot and the Sefirot. We've talked about so far how each midah is a particular created character trait by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and how he guides his world, and how we're meant to guide our world. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yisod, and Malchut. Right? And additionally, we've talked about how certain individuals fix those midot into the world. Who is it? Chesed? Who's Gvura? Who's Tiferet?
Yaakov.
Now there's a third layer which we've discussed, and what's now we're going to emphasize even further. What else does this parallel?
The human body.
Different parts of the human body, because we're created at Tselem Elokim. What's Chesed?
Head.
No. The right arm. Gvura is?
The left arm.
So what is Tiferet?
The spine.
The Tiferet is the spine. It's the center of the body. The physical manifestation in the Tzelem Elohim is comprised by the Midot in the human form is Tiferet, is Yaakov, is balance, is creating, balancing the right arm and the left arm, the right side and the left side, bringing them together in a way where they can function harmoniously. That's what Tiferet is doing. It's that balance. It's that center line. It's that centerpiece. That's what Yaakov is. And to, unfortunately, weigh too quickly, give it its final piece. We have a pasuk which describes somewhat, a little bit of how even in letters, the differentiation between Olam Hazeh or Shamay or Aretz and Olam Haba, Shamayim. That pasuk is quoted by Chazal, particularly in a Rashi at the beginning of Perek Bet of Bereshit, Bereshit Bet Dalid, on the word Behi Bar'am. So there's a small hay. Chazal say, what is that hay representing? Rashi brings this down in there in Bereshit. He quotes the pasuk, Ki Beka Hashem Tzur Olamim. Let's go with it. Okay, Ki Beka Hashem Tzur Olamim. Sorry about my handwriting. The way that's understood by Chazal is that with the name Yud and then a Hey, does God create Olamim, worlds? Worlds. Which worlds?
Us.
Which worlds? Simply. Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. The two worlds that exist. Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. Ki Bekash and Sur Olamim. Hey is this world and Yud is Olam Haba. More to unpack in that at a different point. Yud is Olam Haba. Hey is Olam Hazeh. Yud is the origin point. Yud is the initial point of origin, that singular dot from which all explodes forth. The Big Bang, so to speak, is where everything is coming from. That origin point is the Yud. That's Olam Haba. That's the singular unified source. What is the lowest part of the human being?
Feet.
The feet. What part of the foot do we normally identify as the lowest part of the foot?
Heel.
In English, that's?
Akev.
Akev or Akev.
You said in Hebrew.
I apologize. In Hebrew. Is Akev or Akev. What are we defining Yaakov as? He's the person who unifies Shemayim and Aretz, Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. What is his name?
Yaakov.
Yud Akev. He's unifying the Yud, that's the origin point, that's the Olam Haba side, with the Akev, which is the lowest point, which is the most physical side. Yud Akev. Yaakov. If Yud is indicative of Olam Haba, spiritual, transcendental, Shamayim, the origin of all things, the Akev is the lowest place physically. He is the center line that's binding the highest place to the lowest place. He's the individual who's encapsulating that. He's having a dream about that where? At Beit HaMikdash, which is all about creating a space for God to penetrate, for Shemayim to come and kiss the Aretz, for the upper realms, for the spiritual reality to penetrate and access the physical world. And which is both themselves are a microcosm for Bereshit Bara Elokim et HaShemayim ve'et HaAretz, the very structure of the universe itself. All three parallel in themselves. Yaakov is having this vision at night. He's seeing it as he goes into Galus, into exile, a place where he is going to have to struggle to fully ignite himself as his Yaakov side, to unite the spiritual and the physical. He leaves the space where he's sitting in Beis Medrash all day, and he's going into the physical world to build a family, to have a life, to get a job. That's what happens in the Parsha. He's unifying, constantly maintaining the Shemayim and linking it to Aretz, bringing together in an impossible way the spiritual and the physical in anything that he does, in everything that he does, which is the hardest to do during exile, which is the hardest to do in the darkness. And the one last piece is, we said that it's impossible to see the Shemayim really, that structure really, while we're in it. Because if we're in Olam Hazeh, you can't fully see in its totality Olam Habah, you're still in the system. When a person goes to sleep, what happens?
Your soul goes to Shemayim.
And we can, and
we dream.
We dream, and we experience. What's the experience for us, as the Gemara puts it? It's 1/60th of
death.
He goes and goes to sleep, where he leaves this world behind a little bit, and then he's able to see from the outside what the structure of reality is meant to look like. In that dream, seeing that goal, seeing that structure, seeing who he is and his relationship to the Beit HaMikdash, and who he's meant to be and become. In Yaakov, Tiferet, Yirakev, Shemayim Ba'aretz, Besulam, all of these things coming together. I'm going to stop there. It was a lot. Pleasure packing it in, but I didn't want to break it up into two. Any final questions or thoughts or reflections on the many things we just put up on the board?
Yeah. Wait, so he went through the Beit Midrash, which represents Olam Haba, and then goes to darkness?
He was living in a place of just learning Torah, so to speak, whatever Torah there existed then. He learned Torah and was just living in a place of Shemayim, of engaging godliness.
Yeah,
and he has to go out from there to work the land, be a shepherd, find a wife and finds wives, has many children.
All the physical things.
And continue to maintain that unification of Shemayim in the arts.
And what also about death? And what was death?
Well, we'll clarify that afterward. Okay. That's fine. Just that little piece, that's okay.
All right.
Good? To be continued, we'll pick up from here on Wednesday.